Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's gonna hate you. She's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM, this December 1st, 2015 edition, episode 666, Sign of the Beast. Or maybe it's only episode 66, could be, although some people claim that guy's the devil. Of Nature Bats Last comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico. Our thanks to Afrazin for his incredible theme song contribution. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. We played a B-side last week, which is pretty good. I like the B-side as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Erase.
Erase, about Erase. The elimination or the extinction of the human race. Today's a call-in show as well, so you can dial us up at 888-874-4888. We also have a live studio audience. Studio audience.
Yay!
45,000 people.
Barely fit into the 680 square foot mud hut.
Right. So it's packed in here, and I can barely move. We're also joined today by our friend and colleague, Paul Marcotte, our favorite Canadian in the world, who I think is going to do a poetry reading later.
Maybe not.
Or not.
Or not.
And Paul is in the midst of his sixth visit to the mud hut, and so how's it going?
Oh, it's been great. Guy and Sheila have been wonderful hosts, and I'm really enjoying my time here.
Oh, excellent. How much longer are you staying, really?
Well, I could stay forever down here, but I'm actually leaving on the 11th of December.
Okay.
So,
right. We don't want the NSA on you or anything like that.
No. Do you want me to give them the flight details
no.
so they can track where I'm going?
Okay.
No, they already know. We don't need to know.
That's right.
So we're going to start off with what guy?
Well, let's start off with a little clip. This is a 2.5 minute clip from Paul Beckwith.
Okay.
He was preparing to go to Paris for COP21.
Right. And COP21, for those that don't know, is?
The Conference of Parties, the United Nations framework on climate change. And it's commonly called COP, whatever year it is. This is its 21st year. We'll call it COP Out 21. It's 21st year in a row that nothing will be done about emissions except to cause them to go up further.
Right.
So Paul Beckwith, climate scientist at the University of Ottawa in Canada, fellow Canadian with Paul Marcotte, is on his way to, or probably has already arrived at COP 21. And he put out a little video clip a couple of days ago. And we're going to play that right now, and then we're going to comment on it, and
okay.
probably not favorably.
Okay.
So take it away, studio.
Hello, I'm Paul Beckwith, and I'm going to talk about what I see as the necessary requirement to be achieved in COP21 in Paris. At COP21, many countries are negotiating to reduce CO2 emissions. And this is the most important thing. In fact, I was at a parade today in downtown Ottawa that about 25,000 people attended, and the push is to have 100% renewable energy by 2050. We have the technology to do this. What we just need is the will and the nudges from the top levels of government to achieve this. But reducing emissions, zeroing emissions, in fact, is one of the legs of the bar stool, if you like. There's two other legs that are just as important. The second leg is carbon dioxide removal. We've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere with our emissions, and this has destabilized the climate. This is causing amplification of warming in the Arctic, which has lowered the temperature gradient between the Arctic and the equator, which causes the jet streams to slow down and become wavier, and causes increases in frequency, severity, and duration of extreme weather events, torrential rains causing floods, desert conditions in other regions. So we need to do carbon dioxide removal to lower the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere and in the oceans, and that will prevent ocean acidification from taking out the phytoplankton, which is the base of the marine food chain. The third plank is the third leg of the stool is solar radiation management. Because the Arctic is warming much faster than the equator, it's disrupted the jet streams and the global atmospheric circulation patterns, as well as the ocean currents. The Gulf Stream, for example, is not moving as far north, and we're seeing large cold regions of water just south of Greenland. So the ocean currents are shifting, which is very serious. So we need to look at solar radiation management methods to try to cool the Arctic to restore the stability of the climate system. Thank you.
Okay. I'll go first.
Please do. Hold me back. Somebody hold me back.
First thing out of the gate, he legitimizes, is that a word?
Legitimizes
COP21. Yeah. Like somehow that is a potential start or a solution. Second,
right, the first 20.
Yeah.
The outcome was for carbon emissions to set an all-time record right after the first 20 COP out meetings.
Right.
But this one is the real deal.
Right. Second, renewable energy by 2050.
This is from Mark Z. Jacobson at Stanford University. This is a guy who a couple of years ago said we'd be there by 2030.
Right. And when I can guarantee you, if we ever, by some miracle, make it to 2050, it'll be 2075 when we
get to Philly. Absolutely.
And then follow shortly after that, we have to depend on the top levels of government to get there to use this renewable. So we're depending on a hierarchy. We're depending on people that have never been dependable. Ever. That's right. Why we're here.
Right.
And then the bar stool, my favorite.
Wait. We can depend upon them for some things.
Right.
Conquest.
Sure.
Patriarchy.
Extinction.
Oppression. Extinction. A lot of things. So don't say they're not reliable.
and then the bar stool.
Which is not a bad idea right now.
Why don't we dismantle so there isn't a bar stool to talk about?
Yes.
And then finally, he never actually mentions civilization at all, mm-hmm. or the dismantling of it. And yet,
what do we know? What do we know about civilization? It's a heat engine.
It's a heat engine.
Yes. So let's keep it going,
right?
But somehow turn off the heat.
So I'm confused. I'm confused on some levels. And we've had Paul on the show. Mm-hmm. We had him on about a year ago, actually. Mm-hmm. And I'm confused why we're still listening to him. I really am.
Because we listened to him a year ago, and you think that's enough?
Well, I mean, he's all over the place. He's all over the groups that we follow. He's all over radio shows.
He admitted at COP20 that we had triggered abrupt climate change that will take us to 5 to 6 or maybe 10 C above baseline within the next decade or two. That's what he said a year ago, and he said it's unstoppable.
Yeah.
Unless we do things, absurd things, like solar radiation management.
Yeah, his solution is engineering, and engineering has put us here. And so we're continuing down the line and the path of what has put us in this particular position.
I think you're just being a pessimistic bummer, Mike.
Maybe I just need a hug.
Aww.
Come here, you damn Canadian.
Okay, family show here.
Well, you guys go about that. I'll talk a little bit more about plankton later in the show, in the climate change science part of the show, which we'll get to after our conversation with Gail Teverberg.
All right. Well, so today we're chatting with Gail Teverberg. Gail is an actuary who sometimes writes online as Gail the Actuary. coincidentally. She writes prolifically about energy issues at ourfiniteplanet.com. Thanks for joining us on Nature Bats Last, Gail. Are you there, Gail?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you. I'm just pointing out it's our finite world, not our finite planet.
Oh, our finite world. Our apologies. Gotcha. Thank you. So it's ourfiniteworld.com, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
That was my mistake. That was a horrible mistake.
Oh my goodness.
That was a Freudian slip of the magnificent proportion.
Well, let's start off with something pretty basic. Apparently, we can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. Is that correct?
We really can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. I know you usually talk about climate change, but there are other reasons why we can't. I think the big issue is that we start reaching diminishing returns. As they say, it takes more and more energy to try to produce the things that we're producing. It takes more workers just to produce the oil and to produce the metals and produce any of the goods that we're producing. And we become less efficient rather than more efficient, and the system stops growing. And the distribution of wages changes, and a lot of things change, and the system doesn't work the way it did before.
And so when you talk to people, because when I even mention limits to growth, I get this puzzled look, and people actually know what I talk about. It's not like I'm just dropping this bomb on them. And they literally have a very difficult time overcoming the narrative in their head about progress. Do you find that just when you're having general conversations or in your writing?
I think so, to some extent. I think what happens is people believe what they hear repeated enough times. Mm-hmm. And what we hear from our government and from our science courses is we can solve any problem. You know, we've been growing for a long time. Clearly that will happen. We have pension plans that are designed for the next 100 years. We have Social Security. Our governments have lasted for a couple hundred years. They certainly should last longer. There's no problem ahead. Don't worry about it. So if you keep hearing these reassurances over and over again from people you trust, you start believing that, well, that's the way the world works, and these other people are a bunch of nuts.
You're calling my name there. About a month ago, Gail, you posted an essay at Our Finite World titled, "Oops, Low Oil Prices Are Related to a Debt Bubble." The bottom line from that essay is the take-home message, quote, "We should not be too surprised if the economy starts taking major downward steps in the next few months." So let's unpack that sentence a bit. What do you mean by downward steps?
Well, I think the one of the big issues is debt and repayment of that debt. And I think, you know, we've already been seeing a number of big debt defaults recently. I think Detroit went into bankruptcy this last year. Now, Puerto Rico, there was just something in the paper today that, you know, they had missed an earlier interest payment or only made a partial payment, and they've got another one coming up in a week. But then we're seeing other companies, too. I think the biggest solar company in Spain that has something like 29,000 employees is on the edge of bankruptcy, and they're talking about, you know, what's going to happen there. And there's a U.S. subsidiary of that company that's not yet in bankruptcy, but it's got issues as well. And we can think of a number of coal companies that are going in, look like they're on the edge of bankruptcy, and, of course, the natural gas and oil companies.
Yeah,
so I think that's the big issue, is that this debt kind of thing and the way that works through the economy.
Okay. So far, though, the one-size-fits-all solution to too much debt is to print more money. And I understand that every dollar printed is a dollar of debt, and that U.S. debt exceeds all the currency in the world, plus all the dug out of the ground in the history of the world. But why can't the Federal Reserve System in the United States and the other central banks around the world just print more money? I mean, it's worked so far, and the people appear oblivious to that fact. So why don't we just double down on the insanity that's already going?
Well, for one thing, right now the government is talking about raising interest rates, which is sort of the opposite direction. So they don't even have their mind thinking in that direction, so they may inadvertently cause more problems as opposed to fix it. So I think that's one of the reasons is that people, I'm not quite sure what they're doing, looking at the U.S. economy and saying we're doing better than the rest of the world. You know, the rest of the world is thinking in the way of printing more money, but the U.S. is going the opposite direction, thinking about raising interest rates. So I think that's one of the obstacles. But really the issue is that you have to somehow or other get the price of the commodities and of oil and all of these things back up again. And what and the, these low oil prices are really an the way limits to growth appear. It's because there's not enough wages, especially of the non-elite workers, ordinary rank-and-file workers. More of this work is being transferred to places like China and India and even Africa, and these workers are making tiny amounts. I remember reading $21 a month in Africa. And so, you know, these workers can't afford to buy the output of the system, and the system just doesn't work when the workers can't buy the output of the system. But people haven't realized that they have to get the wages down to actually that low level, you know, to the workers to make the thing go. Instead, they print the money and they get it in the stock market, and that's as far as it goes.
Right, and I suspect that that could and perhaps will happen again this month, because the Federal Reserve System has talked about raising interest rates before, and then the stock market goes up on command when the Fed fails to raise rates as they have suggested they will do. But that doesn't get to the big matter that you're talking about. And going back to your original quote here, we should not be too surprised if the economy starts taking major downward steps in the next few months. So I thought all the big economic events occurred in autumn historically. You know, when we think about stock market crashes, we think about September and October events. Sell in May and go away, that sort of sentiment. So can you talk more about what might happen in a few months?
Well, the interest reevaluation on the oil loans came due as of the September 30th, October 1st date. But then it also comes up again in 6 months, as of the end of, you know, March 31st. It would be the end of the first quarter. So this question keeps coming up as to how to handle these loans. I think all of these other debt issues keep coming up as well. I think, you know, the sell in May and go away, it reflects kinds of things that happen just because of the cyclical nature of, say, farming and some of these other things that impact how the system works. But I think if there are overall structural changes that are going wrong, those breaks in the systems can show up any time. You know, we had Enron come along, and I don't remember what month of the year it came, but it didn't follow any particular pattern. You know, if we have some big problem with, say, the European Union, it doesn't necessarily happen in any particular month. Or if there's an overthrow of one of the major governments in the Middle East, that doesn't necessarily happen in any particular month. So I think we can have things happen in ways that we don't really anticipate, and not necessarily at a particular time of year. And they sort of build on each other, you know, depending on what exactly happens.
Okay, that's fair enough. Enron was caught out in October, but the bankruptcy took a while before it was complete, of course. Greece is a fine example of a country that just seems to keep going. It's been teetering on the brink for several years, which was predicted even before the Eurozone adopted a common currency. But it just keeps teetering, and there's no end in sight. So what will it take to push Greece and the entire Eurozone and by extension, the entire monetary system over the cliff? Will it take more of the same that's been going on in Greece and just ratcheting up? Will it take an increase in the interest rates by the Federal Reserve System? What lies out there as mines we might step on or not?
Well, one of them, of course, is on the Spain side. There's the big bankruptcy that's pending. That's, I think it's, whatever, $29 billion or something of that sort. That's off in Spain. But, you know, when you start having, if Greece is having problems, if Spain suddenly starts having problems with big layoffs, then you've got pressures on the Eurozone that they have to hold up more than one country. So it can be pressures that are not within Greece that cause the problem. They're pressures elsewhere that you can't keep the whole system going together. I'm not really quite sure. You know, we keep hearing about all these refugee issues. I think that that's going to take a lot of work to accommodate all of those refugees, just trying to keep the system going so that they're not accommodating quite so many would seem to be a big help. If there's not resources to go around, and they start out with, I forget what the exact unemployment rate is, but we'll say 11%, it's hard to see that they're going to find jobs for all these people.
Right. So is this event the last gasp of industrial civilization?
Well, industrial civilization has been building up and up and up and up, and what we've done is we've gotten to a point where we're reaching, you know, oil is our most dense, most easily transported type of energy supply, and that's what's reaching diminishing returns, and the cost keeps rising of extracting it. And so, you know, we don't have a plan B of how we can start over again. So it's hard to see what we can do. There's no way of backtracking with an economy. We can't just say, oh, we're going to all adopt horses. For one thing, we don't have enough horses. And secondly, our cities aren't laid out for horses. So, you know, there just isn't a way you can go backwards to do something different.
So you're saying mules.
right, yeah.
Don't be an ass guy. Let's talk a little bit about you personally. I mean, this we talk about things that are obviously similar and are connected. And how do you deal with this on a personal level, emotionally?
I guess it hasn't been a huge problem. I mean, I have friends, and my life is not built around, you know, what the next 100 years are going to be like. It's, you know, I have a good life now in terms of husband and family, and pretty much take every day as I go. I've been a regular churchgoer since I was a child, so I have my involvement there as well. It's sort of, well, that's the way things are, and we'll just go on with it.
Also, I guess I should point out that this is that you're what we're talking to you about is at least at some level separate from your professional life, not to mention your personal life, right? That you're an actuary in real life. And so writing about limits to growth doesn't necessarily come into play there, is that right?
Well, no, that's, in fact, that's sort of, I mean, it's closely related, and in fact, that's part of the reason I left doing the consulting work, is, you know, the whole idea that you can build a pension system and that you can build all of these kinds of systems depends on everlasting growth. And actuaries are the people who determine these amounts and how you fund them. So I couldn't be in a position and write about this kind of thing and stay in that profession. You know, I'm kind of right on the cutting edge of exactly where the rubber hits the road on this. So, you know, it was, I very much was involved with this kind of thing. That's why I would be one of the first people to see that kind of thing.
Ah, so taking an analogy from now, from that, in that case, if I'm the cause of abrupt climate change, you're the cause of economic collapse.
Phew. Maybe so.
I think Paul has a question for you.
Hi, Gail. Okay. It's Paul here. I just wanted you to make a comment. It seems that, you know, all these governments around the world keep printing money to try and get some economic growth going, but they don't probably look at the fact that a greater and greater percentage of the energy that is extracted is just used to maintain the system as it is, let alone try and grow more things. Can you comment on that?
Yeah. Well, and I think it's probably deeper than that. It's not so much that the energy is used to do the, you know, extraction. There's some other related things that the wages that the people earn are going lower, and it's the return on human labor that's going lower. And that's the big issue that I think becomes a problem, as much as this return on the energy return is lower. The connection with the energy return is, it's not really as direct as one might think.
So, obviously...
The human labor is wages, and the fact that there's more disparity of wages is more the problem.
And that disparity, as I understand it, is growing with every passing year. Is that right?
Exactly, yeah.
Uh-huh. So can you differentiate for us between hyperinflation and deflation? As I understand it, we're in a deflationary spiral now. And which of those is more likely to cause cessation of this set of living arrangements, and how soon might that come? That's a lot of questions. Sorry about that.
Right. Well, I guess as I see it is that there's really three alternatives. You know, there's the deflation, and there's hyperinflation, and there's what I call discontinuity. And that's just that your banks close, or, you know, the electricity goes off, or something equivalent. You still have the money in your bank account, but you can only get out $50 a day. And I think discontinuity is the one that always strikes me as being the likely outcome, as opposed to inflation or deflation. I mean, we've got deflation right now. But I suppose if somehow or other you could keep it all together, then maybe you could get hyperinflation. But I would see more of an issue of something happening so that, for example, some of the bank accounts have haircuts so that, for instance, maybe employers would not have enough money to pay their payroll for their employees. And because of that, there's big job loss. You know, it would be a different kind of an impact than what you're looking at, is what you're thinking of.
Right, and that's consistent with, oh, I can't remember the guy's name, writing, I think it was on June 30th, 2012, for the Foster Group, indicated that as little as a disruption, some sort of disruption in anything we view as necessary, like food, electricity, disruption of the bond markets, whatever, credit markets, would cause industrial civilization to cease in as little as 3 weeks. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about? I'm having a hard time coming up with the guy's
name. I'm not sure that I'm familiar with that, but, oh, okay, Dave Korovitz's report?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. Right, and what he's looking at is how the connections go there, you know, that you have to have the right people in place. You know, there's so many thousands of different jobs, And there's so many connections in different places that you can't just take out a piece of it and have the whole system hang together. And he's looked at a variety of different pieces of how this works. And he said, you know, it takes relatively little time for the whole system to just kind of disentangle.
Right, and that's the sort of disruption you're thinking about as well?
I think there's a possibility of it. I think the one thing I have noticed, though, you know, in the insurance business and I guess elsewhere too, is that governments do have a way of changing the rules. You know, I say, well, a bank is solvent if such and such. Oh, well, we've just decided to change the rules and we'll let them be solvent even if, you know, the conditions are a little bit different or something. So there can be some kind of mitigation or temporary mitigation to keep things together. But there is always this possibility that David Korowitz points out that things could go downhill very quickly once things get started, just because of the way the system depends on all of the pieces of the system depend on other pieces of the system.
You're listening to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network, and we're speaking with Gail Tverberg about economic collapse, really, amongst other things. You can call in if you have a question at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Gail, do you think that the general public, as you know, you interact with them, is oblivious to a possibility of collapse, or do you feel that there's some sort of underlying feeling that all is not right in the world?
I think there's quite a few people who understand there's something not right with the world. You know, I've discovered there's, you know, quite a number of people that I know in my so-called day-to-day life, or maybe going to church with me or something, who are regular readers of my blog. And, you know, they kind of realize there's something going wrong, and they said, oh, I'm going to look at this and see what's going on. So, you know, there are a variety of people out there. I think what happens right now, one of the things is that people have had their minds so focused on this idea that we're up against, peak oil. And peak oil means high prices, and these aren't high prices, so that peak oil has gone away. But they just didn't understand that that wasn't the way peak oil would manifest itself in the first place, and that the problem really would be limits to growth, and the limits to growth would come with low prices, not high. So, you know, some people are kind of confused. And especially when they read in the paper, oh, we got more jobs and everything's wonderful. You know, the prices are low, and so there's nothing to worry about.
Right. Yeah, and it sounds like there is something to worry about.
There probably is.
and so how do you respond when people give you the Debbie Downer line? That you must be the most depressing person on the planet.
And,
it is not me, Paul. It's Gail, obviously.
Yeah, I refer to you. What do you mean?
I mean, how do you respond when people say things like that? And I can understand that that's getting personal. If that's too personal, that's fine.
I guess I haven't really run into exactly that kind of an issue. I've tried not to put it in terms too much in terms of, you know, how awful everything will be. You know, I really don't know exactly how things will play out. You know, is there something happening that we just don't understand behind this whole thing? You know, is there some kind of a divine plan behind all of this? There's something happening that we don't understand. I would not completely rule that out, that, you know, you read in the Bible about, you know, the end of the days will come when there are signs in the heavens and all of this kind of thing. Well, maybe that's the plan, and we just don't understand how it's working out.
Gail, Paul here again. Just another question with relation to the sort of 3-month timeline that we were talking about earlier. Is there anything specific that you've looked at that would cause you to think that this might be the company or the thing that is going to cause the disconnect that's going to shut the whole system down?
Well, I think there's just so many different debt pieces, and we've got Glencore, for example, which is a copper miner, and it's got a lot more than just copper. It's got many kind of metals and such things. But we have a bunch of coal companies. We've got a bunch of natural gas and oil companies. We have a bunch of cities, I'm sure, that are on the edge, and states with their debt problems. So I'm not sure that there's any one of them. It's kind of the situation where you're not quite – there's so many things at the edge. And if you start raising interest rates, for example – or if some of the problems in China start becoming more evident here because, for instance, some of those debt defaults, some of the debt that's in U.S. dollars starts defaulting, you know, it's that kind of thing that could make big changes in a fairly big time. And it may be 3 months, and we may be seeing some of the defaults, and it may take a while for it to spill through the system. I don't know if it's going to happen as fast as the 3 weeks of Dave Korovitz.
Thank you.
Okay, so what are the primary challenges you face in your work currently?
What are some of the challenges?
Yeah.
Well, I guess there's always the issue of, well, you have multiple calls on your time, you know, is that I should be involved with academic papers or to being speaking at conferences or writing the posts or whatever. And I do try to respond to the comments on my website, so that gets to be time-consuming, but it also is a way that I get ideas and see where some of the readers are coming from. So anyhow, so I guess it's the usual kind of thing that you have many calls on your time, and it's a question of where you spend your time.
Right. And further along that path, where do you find inspiration for your work?
I always have 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 things that, you know, I'm thinking, oh, I need to write about this. But a lot of the inspiration comes from people, things that the people who have been their commenters, you know, the questions they ask or the things that they're having problems with. Because that says to me, oh, that's something I need to talk about.
Right. So, well, that's great. Thank you very much for taking the time to spend with us today. And we appreciate your pointed responses to our every question. And we look forward to our next conversation with you.
Well, thanks for calling. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Gail.
All right. Back to Paris.
We'll always have Paris.
We'll always have Paris. How long is the conference?
2 weeks. They need 2 weeks to hammer out a deal. 12 days. Okay,
12 days. Okay. I mean, 2 weeks they might get her done, but they're only spending 12 days on it.
Right.
That's the problem.
Right.
Yeah.
If they would commit to the weekend.
And I guess it's really hard for me to read about this, this particular conference, but hey, what is the best hoped outcome that you've seen in the media of what could possibly happen? I've read and heard that the reason there is so much, optimism for this particular conference is because it's not going to be a top-down sort of, here's how we're going to do it. It's going to be based on each individual country's particular situation, and they're bringing in they're getting more of more input from developing countries this time around, whereas developing countries were not really kind of pushed aside and said, hey, you got to do more because you're not as efficient as we are. And so I guess that's what I have seen, and that they figure they're going to come to some sort of, I don't know, I wouldn't use the word consensus, but ideas, solutions based on, because everybody has what they would consider an input this time, and it's based on your individual country's particular situation.
So those quote second and third world countries, mm-hmm. we're going to ask them what they want. And they're going to tell us, stop bombing the shit out of us right. at weddings.
Right.
And stop stealing our oil and our rare earths.
Right.
So that we can burn the planet instead of you guys burning the planet.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that'll fix it?
Apparently.
Well, and there's somebody quoted, I think that was just today or yesterday, someone was very optimistic because they heard Ban Ki-moon say that he actually said, we need to get down to 1.5 degrees above baseline. And so there was all this,
right.
Well, that's wonderful. They're actually talking about 1.5 degrees.
Because it's below 2.
Because it's below
the
2.
Unscientific.
The unscientific target. Yeah. And as everybody sitting here knows, that both of those numbers are long.
Pulled out of a hat.
Exactly. So
yeah. It was nice of you to say hat. It's a family show.
Yeah.
We said that already.
Okay, my favorite thing from the media today comes from Democracy Now! I never thought I would say those words. But here's the headline. The headline at Democracy Now! From today, December 1st, 2015. Quote, Pope Francis to world leaders at UN Climate Summit. And then the quote is from Pope Francis. It
Wait
says,
for it.
We are at the limits of suicide.
I'm not exactly what even that means. The limits of suicide. Suicide has limits, but we are at the limits, therefore we are committing suicide. Is that what he means?
No, so here's the lead.
Oh, here we go.
Pope Francis has warned that the world is heading towards suicide if more is not done to combat climate change.
Right.
Well, how are we gonna unpull the trigger on the clathrate gun?
Well, that's the thing. The Pope, unfortunately, doesn't realize that we're already dead.
Oh, that's right.
But he should. Because he's the Pope.
He could make a call.
Cue the lightning strike.
Can't he make a call? Doesn't he have connections to
Yes. Well, I was listening, even better, I was listening to NPR the other day.
Ooh.
Yes. And I was driving back from Mule Creek.
National Petroleum Radio,
right.
That one?
National uh-huh.
And my excuse is it's the only thing that came in. And they were, who's the lady with the, Diane Reams, is that her name? Reams, she kind of has
Diane
the voice.
Reams, yeah.
Yeah, with the, yeah, I'm Diane Reams, yeah. And she had a couple people on talking about the climate summit, and one of the people, of course, was an energy editor or something from the Wall Street Journal.
Oh, yes.
And she had mentioned that she thought that the conversation, unfortunately, was either about denial or about, and I'm using my own words here, but about doom, that there was no hope. And she said she wishes that the conversation could become a little more in the middle, because obviously climate change is happening, so denial isn't something that, you know, should even be discussed. And really, doom doesn't do anyone any good.
That's no help.
I think she said, yeah, what are we supposed to do with that? And instantly I thought, well, live your life the way you want to instead of the way you think you should be living your life. I think it actually gives you a ticket to live a way that you maybe have never even thought about or considered, because, hey, you can look at it this way. No one here gets out alive, and this guarantees it.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Right. And we've known since we were 11, probably, maybe 14 for some of us slow learners.
Or that weren't alive.
That our own lives are short, mm-hmm. that we're actually mortal.
Right.
You know, that it doesn't just apply to other people. It's also for us.
Yes.
So maybe that should lead us to pursue something besides fiat currency.
Yeah, but that comes back to the narrative that we always have to overcome,
right.
Which is
exactly.
That we don't know we die and we don't know we go extinct. We think we do, but not us.
Right.
Not
everybody
us,
but me.
Everybody
not
else.
Me, not you, Paul. Certainly
no.
not you.
No, of course not.
So I think, and we can't seem to get over that particular hurdle.
I think Wendy from New York nailed it. She just writes this comment mm-hmm. and says, the best outcome is the COP21 is exposed as a farce.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
so 21 times later, maybe we should
right.
start to view the whole thing with a little skepticism.
Exposed to people outside of our small listenership.
Right. Exactly.
That's right.
So go forth after the show.
Right.
Tell everybody that it's a farce.
Yeah, there we go.
Let me come back with a report about how that works out for you.
Right. You got any climate news?
I do have climate news. A paper in the November 18th, 2015 issue of the Cryosphere points out that Greenland climate is now rapidly warming, and as a result, summer melt intensity no longer oscillates around its long-term mean. So instead of calling them exceptional events, those previously exceptional events are becoming normal.
Mm.
So that's a step in the right direction in terms of recognizing abrupt climate changes here.
Right.
When you say right there in the Referee Journal literature that exceptional is normal. Good for them. Paper in the October 19th, 2015 issue of Limnology and Oceanography adds to the abundant literature on methane release from lakes, and I've written about this quite a bit in the long essay. A write-up for the general public titled Global Warming Will Progress Much More Quickly Than Expected, study predicts, includes this line, quote, "The findings suggest we have a vicious circle ahead of us in which the burning of fossil fuels leads to higher temperatures, which in turn trigger higher levels of methane release and further warming," end quote. This is a fine example of a self-reinforcing feedback loop. However, the words "ahead of us" incorrectly suggest the vicious circle is not happening now.
Mm-hmm.
So I've added that tidbit to feedback number 28, the large and growing feedback 28. In fact, weren't we talking about this yesterday, Paul?
Yeah, we were. Seems like
it's 28
every time
alpha?
You turn around, there's yeah. another piece to add to feedback 28.
Yeah, well, increasingly people are starting to focus on these small bodies of water. And increasingly, I'm throwing more stuff into that category. Okay. So that's why Feedback 28 continues to have evidence supplied.
And the other thing we mentioned the other day was when I was talking about when I first started following you, and I think we said that was 2011 probably, that there was no feedback loops. Now we're right. up to, what, 59?
Right. I hadn't reported any at the time. Right. There was already one, I think, in the Referee Journal literature. I just wasn't quite believing it.
Right.
So it wasn't until much later, June sometime, 2012, mm-hmm. when I finally concluded that there were so many self-reinforcing feedback loops that were done. Yeah. And there were five at the time, including methane going atmospheric going exponential in the atmosphere.
And you wrote an essay, "We're Done."
We're Done, time. Yes.
When, how many we have right now listed?
59, I think, isn't it?
59 as of one I haven't even reported yet on today's show.
Oh. So we're actually ahead show-wise compared to feedback loop-wise.
Yes, that's
yes.
right.
Show number
it's
six.
Getting pretty tight.
Winning.
That would be hashtag winning if you're listening. Right.
We can have a special show if you get to the when they're both the same.
That would be a tipping point.
We could bet on that. Maybe we right. could get to
that'd be a feedback
67.
Loop in itself.
I don't think we're ever going to get there.
No,
I think it's in the past.
I think
right. We started the show a little over a year ago when we're already like 20 or 30 or something like that.
Yeah.
And so when we hit 30 or 40 episodes is when we crossed over to the dark side.
To the dark side.
But it's still something fun to keep track of.
Absolutely.
Hashtag fun.
And you do keep track of the numbers. All right.
Absolutely. Somebody suggested that we get Nature Bats Last t-shirt and the number that goes on the back, our number, underneath our name, mm-hmm. right, Marcotte,
right.
he would get number zero.
Okay.
Because he started following my work before I reported any yeah. self-reinforcing feedback. Oh. So he gets a zero.
Nice.
It took me until five or six self-reinforcing feedback loops before I concluded that we were done.
Right.
Mm. So I get like number five or six. Paul Marcotte gets number zero.
I should have waited a little bit longer till there was one.
Yeah.
I'd rather have a number one.
Right,
on my
right.
Back
nobody wants a number zero on their back.
Can you get a negative?
Looks like, yeah. You knew me then.
Yes.
Yeah.
When I was negative. Now I'm Mr. Silver Lining.
Hashtag positive.
There's more.
Oh.
Can I go on?
Yes, please.
Please do.
A paper in the November 23rd, 2015 issue of Journal of Geophysical Research, Earth's Surface, further elucidates the interaction between wildfire and permafrost melt. And I've talked about that quite a bit on the show and written about it some as well. I'll quote from the abstract, quote, "Climate warming is shown to be the dominant factor for permafrost reduction. The warming trend of climate reduces permafrost extent in this region from 67% at present to 2% by, you know the number, 2100. since active layer, and here we're talking about the permafrost active layer, which the permafrost transitions into methane. Since active layer is thicker after a fire and cannot recover in most of the areas, the fire effects on active layer are widespread. On average, fires thicken the active layer by about half a meter. The fire effects on the active layer increased significantly after 1990 due to climate warming. So, yes, the paper adheres to the expected magical date of 2100, but it also points out the acceleration of warming after 1990 and clearly describes the positive interaction between wildfire spread and melting of permafrost. So I think it's quite worthy to check out that paper.
25 years.
Wow. And there's more.
Oh, keep going.
Thank God.
Yeah. And that, as well as most of these others, I've already included in the long essay at Nature Bats Last. The abstract from a paper published in November 25th, 2015, online issue of Bulletin of Mathematical Ecology. Yes, we're talking about the Bulletin of Mathematical Ecology right here on Nature Bats Last. Yeah. Right after we mentioned the numbers, zero, negative numbers, square root of negative one.
Ooh. Hashtag Goodwill Hunting.
There you go. All right, the abstract includes the following lines. The depletion of atmospheric oxygen on a global scale, which, if it happens, obviously can kill most of life on Earth, is another possible catastrophic consequence of the global warming, a global ecological disaster that has been overlooked, end quote. The study shows that an increase in the water temperature of the world's oceans of around 6 degrees Celsius, which is where we're headed in the very near future, could stop oxygen production by phytoplankton by disrupting the process of photosynthesis. And we know that that process is already underway as well, with a significant proportion of phytoplankton having died within the last couple of decades. So here we're talking about the loss of oxygen. I don't know about you, but I think that shit's awesome. Can we have one? Can we have a something from the studio audience about oxygen?
You just sucked all the oxygen out of the room.
I did. Ooh, that was bad. According to a paper published in November 26, 2015, issue of Nature Communications, quote, outlet glaciers grounded on a bed that deepens inland and extends below sea level are potentially vulnerable to marine ice sheet instability. This instability, which may lead to runaway ice loss, has been simulated in models, but its consequences have not been directly observed in geological records. Here we provide new surface exposure ages from an outlet of the East Antarctic ice sheet that reveal rapid glacier thinning occurred approximately 7,000 years ago in the absence of large environmental changes. Glacier thinning persisted for more than 2.5 centuries, resulting in hundreds of meters of ice loss, end quote. So the take-home message here is the East Antarctic ice sheet, which was believed immune to rapid change as little as a year ago, is capable of essentially going away in a short period of time as a result of very minor changes in global average temperature.
Have you seen anything how that would affect sea rise?
Well, the East Antarctic ice shelf is much larger than the West Antarctic ice shelf, which would be responsible for 20 feet of sea level rise by itself. So it's a big number.
Hashtag we're fucked.
Don't buy the condo in Florida.
Right.
I've added this information to feedback number 14. Paper in the November 26th, 2015 issue of Science, that's the big one, reports the rapid increase in, I don't know how to pronounce this. Can you help me out, Paul Marcotte?
Cocoa Puffs.
Cocoa Puffs.
Coccolithophores.
Well, I'm going with Paul
or
on
that.
This one. Coccolithophores. So the paper in Science reports the rapid increase in coccolithophores in response to increased carbon dioxide. The algae, these are algae, the coccolithophores, or cocoa puffs, are algae, and they make it more difficult to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere in the short term. So this thus is born self-reinforcing feedback loop number 56.
They're within 10.
Of the irreversible variety, 59 total, 56 that are irreversible at temporal spans relative.
Within 7.
Go, baby, go. And it keeps going.
Okay.
According to the BBC News from November 27, 2015, yes, this is the BBC, it's not the Referee Journal article literature, quote, public support for tough climate deal declines.
No.
Uh-oh. I'll quote from the article. Public support for a strong global deal on climate change has declined, according to a poll carried out in 20 countries. Only four now have majorities in favor of their governments setting ambitious targets at a global conference in Paris. In a similar poll before the Copenhagen meeting in 2008, eight countries had majorities favoring climate tough action. Just under half of those surveyed viewed climate change as a very serious problem this year, compared to 63% in 2009. That's the story. Apparently, terrorism has the citizenry preoccupied.
Wow, yeah.
If I were a conspiracy realist, I mean a conspiracy theorist, I might imagine the false flag attacks. I mean the terrorist attacks in Paris are actually distracting the comfortable masses. Mm. Conspiracy theorist, by the way, is a term popularized in 1967 by the United States Central Intelligence Agency to disparage people who are capable of actually connecting the dots. Cuckoo. Martial law, in effect, has been implemented in Paris as would-be protesters are hauled away.
Wow. So you can't even protest anymore?
No.
Well, it's frightening.
Not in Paris you can't.
No.
You can protest right now in Clift, New Mexico.
Yeah. I don't think you can protest in Brussels either.
No. No, absolutely not. And if you do, you better have your latest passport printed for you in Turkey to drop right there on the ground. Yesterday's issue of the Washington Post has the following headline, quote, lakes are forming on top of Mount Everest's glaciers.
Oh.
Wow.
Oh, that's inconvenient. You know how high Lake or Mount Everest is?
Yeah. Just well, I don't, but a lot of millionaires do.
29,028 feet, I think.
It's like way, that. Well, that used to be until it all started melting.
Yeah, okay, I guess.
You need to be a Sherpa or have a huge bank account to be up there.
Yeah. So.
And then leave your gear behind, of course.
So I don't think that can be a good thing.
No.
That Mount Everest glaciers are turning into lakes. I said 28,000 feet or 29,000.
29.
Well, I don't know how high the lakes are.
It's way up there. It says on top of Mount Everest's glacier, so it means it's way up there.
Yeah.
We'll give it above 20,000.
Probably at least near base camp. Base camp's 21,000 feet.
Yeah.
So that's my guess. All right. So we're ready to wrap?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Time flies.
Okay, well.
When you're listening to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network.
Well, then make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last and Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. And feel free to post questions you like to ask on the show, and please continue to file Guy's blog at
GuyMcPherson.com
for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. And we'll see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern. It's a call-in show and a very important one, so please start writing up your questions and comments. It's also a call-out show. We'll be calling out climate scientist Michael Mann for his malpractice, and we've invited him to call in on the show himself.
Yes, I sent him a note indicating that we're going to point out the malpractice he's been generating, and especially with respect to the 2C political target,
right,
and ask him to join the show. We'll see how that turns out.
So please send us your favorite pieces of evidence, and we'll use them on the show. You can post them on both of our pages. You can find us on Facebook and PRN and like us in the archives at iTunes. And thanks again for the calls this week and to Gail. Until next time, remember the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.